I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. In this episode of Cybercrime Radio, we will be discussing sensitive subject matter that may be better suited for mature audiences and include language and topics not suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Joining me today is Dr. Asia Eaton, Associate Professor of Psychology at Florida International University and Head of Research at CCRI, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. CCRI's mission is to combat online abuses that threaten civil rights and civil liberties. They're the nation's preeminent nonprofit organization working to protect vulnerable groups from threats such as non-consensual pornography, sexual extortion, digitally manipulated audiovisual material or deepfakes, and other online abuses. CCRI provides model legislation, legal analysis, and amicus briefs on issues related to privacy and free expression. CCRI has provided support to over 7,000 victims of NCP through the CCRI Crisis Helpline. And to learn more about CCRI, please visit cybercivilrights.org. Welcome, Dr. Eaton. So great to have you with us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So to start off, Dr. Eaton, I gave an overview of CCRI just now, but can you share with us more about what the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative does, what the history of CCRI is, and how you got involved?
Absolutely. So I've been working with CCRI since 2016, and they have a number of services that they provide and issues that they're involved in. They do victim services, public education and awareness. They work with the tech industry. They do legislative support, and they do legal and psychological research. And that's the branch that I'm the most involved in. We have done several studies looking at the prevalence of image-based sexual abuse in the United States, including one focusing on non-consensual porn in particular. And we found that as many as 1 in 8 individuals have been victimized by non-consensual porn in the United States when you count both threats and the actual experience of victimization. We've also looked at the means by which non-consensual porn is perpetrated, deterrence to perpetration, methods of perpetration, health correlates. I guess I should start, though, by defining non-consensual porn, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
So non-consensual porn, otherwise known as revenge porn, is the non-consensual dissemination of intimate images. So sending someone's images or posting them without their consent. It is an emerging form of intimate partner violence when it's perpetrated in intimate relationships. And it has serious and long-term consequences for victims.
And so in that, I think you were referencing the 2017 nationwide online study that you and your team conducted, which was the first ever nationwide study that revealed some of those shocking statistics. What are some of those outcomes that being a victim of NCP entails?
So we found that men and women victims had lower mental health and physical or somatic well-being scores than non-victims. There's also research by Bates in 2017 that found victims of non-consensual porn experienced PTSD-like symptoms. There's research more recently finding that individuals experience problems with their social lives. They experience economic consequences. So it's a variety of long-term and severe effects.
And NCP, that happens to folks who have shared intimate content of themselves with those that they are involved in a relationship with, right? It's not. Or could it be other things as well? I guess that's a question I have.
Yeah, it's a great question. Most in our research, most victims of non-consensual porn were victimized by current or former partners. So the images were probably shared initially in a consensual relationship and were intended to be confined to that relationship. And then they were non-consensually distributed outside of that relationship, whether it's by text, email, posting online, showing a friend on your phone. But there were also individuals who were victimized by strangers, who were victimized by relatives, friends, or ex-friends. So while it often occurs, most often occurs in intimate partner relationships, it can occur outside of that context as well.
Now, how does that happen? Like with the stranger scenario, for example, is that something where perhaps someone's camera is taken over and the victim doesn't know that that's happening and, you know, content's recorded of them? Or I guess, can you help me understand that a little further?
Yeah, absolutely. The taping could be without an individual's consent as well as the distribution, right? So they could be taped surreptitiously. Their images could be hacked. That's happened to celebrities where their image database was hacked and the images were released without their consent. Could be that your phone is stolen and someone gets the photos from your phone.
Right, right. And there's also, you also research recorded sexual assault and sextortion. What's the difference there? What do those entail that it differentiates from non-consensual pornography?
So non-consensual pornography is an umbrella term that indicates any time that intimate images are distributed without the consent of the individuals in them. Now, that could also include recorded sexual assault, in which the event or image that is depicted was not depicts a non-consensual intimate exchange. Rape or assault, for example. It could also include sextortion, where the images are distributed with the threat of more images being distributed unless the person performs sexual favors or gives money, or the threat of the images being distributed unless the person provides more images, or it's in a form of extortion using non-consensual porn.
Okay, great. Thank you for clarifying that. And you mentioned some of the challenges that victims face after the abuse and or violence have taken place. You mentioned some financial ramifications. Why is that? Is it that their images or content are posted in these, you know, public places and people are seeing it, and that's part of what kind of creates that outcome for them, or what's going on there?
That's a great question. How is it that being a victim of non-consensual porn could affect you economically? Well, a lot of individuals experience trauma, which makes it difficult for them to work and to go about their daily activities. Other individuals are actually fired from their positions. There's a case of an elementary school teacher being fired because her images were seen by parents and community members related to the school where she worked. There's examples of individuals who are afraid to even really leave the house for fear of running into people who've seen the images. So there's also the cost of taking the images down. Takedown services can be expensive. Hiring a lawyer to try to achieve justice when you've been victimized is expensive.
Right, right. And so it sounds like there's a pretty heavy stigma surrounding non-consensual pornography, even for the victims.
Oh, absolutely. I think especially because this is a gender-based form of violence in which women are more often victims and men are more often perpetrators. And we live in a society where we have sexual double standards. Women's sexual behavior is condemned more than men's. And in fact, you know, there's a bonus that men accrue for being sexually active and a penalty that women accrue for being sexually active. So, you know, there's a stigma against it, and that stigma is especially harmful to women who represent the majority of victims.
And I've read that domestic abuse has increased during the pandemic. So is that true also about cybersexual abuse and violence?
Yes. CCRI, for example, has seen about a 40% increase in calls to their hotline for victims sent in 2020. The UK revenge porn hotline has seen a similar increase in calls. I'm in the middle of conducting a study, an NSF, National Science Foundation funded study, that actually is examining cyber sexual abuse during COVID and looking at some of the risk factors, correlates, and consequences for diverse individuals in the United States. And we're also trying to see if we can detect an increase as a result of people's increased use of technology during the pandemic, for example. So we do know anecdotally that calls to these hotlines are increasing. We're still waiting on the hard statistics to see if people report more victimization now than they did a year or two ago.
Okay, interesting. And recently I saw, I don't know if you saw this, but there was an article or story rather that came out about a Pennsylvania mother who allegedly sent explicit deepfake photos and video of her teenage daughter's cheerleading rivals to their coaches to try to get them kicked off of the team. So I know your studies deal with those over the age of 18, but those are not the only individuals at risk here, correct?
Oh, no, absolutely not. The CCRI deals more with adult perpetrators and victims because anyone who is a victim under the age of 18 is also under the, jurisdictions and laws that relate to child pornography. And so there are firm laws against the creation and distribution of child pornography. There are no currently federal laws prohibiting the creation and distribution of non-consensual porn, although there is a federal law on the table that's being voted on presently.
Okay, interesting. And so with the in the instance of this mother, I mean, I guess if they were teenagers, then they are children. So then that, although it's, I guess the deep fake is interesting, and I don't know how much you know about that subject, but although it's not actually them, it's their faces put on, potentially, allegedly, their faces put on the bodies of others. Like, where does that kind of fall? I guess that's an interesting one.
Yeah, that definitely is included in what CCRI and I define as non-consensual porn.
Okay.
It's an intimate image, albeit a faked one, of someone being distributed without their consent.
What other ways do criminals lure and trick folks into non-consensual porn? Are there other like tactics that are used that are kind of widespread?
Well, like we mentioned before, very often the images are shared in the context of a consensual romantic relationship and then, later non-consensually distributed outside of that relationship. But there are other ways that people get a hold of intimate images of others. Sometimes they will extort them for intimate images and then use the intimate images to extort them further.
Okay.
Sometimes, like we mentioned before, they will steal or hack the images or maybe even get them from a friend.
Right. And I'm guessing that the extortion, if you comply, you don't probably, I don't know what the statistic would be, but probably you don't actually experience your content being pulled. I mean, is that fair to say? Probably that you wouldn't get kind of like ransomware in a way. Like if you pay the ransom, it's not guaranteed that you're going to get your access to your device back that's been compromised.
Absolutely. There's plenty of cases in which victims have been threatened with the distribution of their non-consensual images. They complied and then the images were distributed anyway. So there's definitely no guarantee that someone threatening you with an image won't disseminate it if you concede to their coercion.
And so you and the research team at CCRI, you're conducting studies, you're helping raise awareness, but what more can we do to help destigmatize this subject and help raise awareness for victims?
Sure. There's plenty of recommendations that we have at the level of individuals and also at the level of organizations and structures. First, absolutely educating people about the harms of non-consensual porn, helping them to understand that this can have severe and long-lasting effects for victims on their mental and physical well-being, on their economic and social well-being. helping educate people about the laws. There's now 48 states where this is illegal. Now, the laws vary from state to state, and some are better than others, but it is illegal in most places under certain conditions. So educating people is first and foremost. It's also important for organizations to develop a culture of zero tolerance. So, you know, I was once asked to come to Quantico and talk to the Marines about instances of non-consensual porn that some former and current Marines had perpetrated on the platform Facebook. And I expressed to them that it's important that they have a culture of zero tolerance. Research shows that people are more likely to report sexual harassment and assault that they observe as a bystander when the organization has a zero tolerance culture, compared to just, you know, your standard type, oh, we don't discriminate and we take harassment and discrimination seriously type culture. But a truly zero tolerance culture will help reporting and will decrease perpetration. It's also important for organizations and individuals to avoid victim blaming. You know, to this day, I hear people say, well, he or she shouldn't have taken the image to begin with, or he or she shouldn't have sent the image to their partner to begin with. And, you know, that's victim blaming that helps protect perpetrators. The truth is that in intimate relationships, we do intimate things. We have sex, we send intimate images, we share intimate feelings and secrets. And that's the nature of a healthy intimate relationship. So there's nothing wrong with sharing images with your partner. The problem is when they violate your consent by disseminating them outside of the context of that relationship. So we need to avoid victim blaming. Police, educators, everyday people need to recognize that there is no, you know, the victim could never have imagined that this would be sent outside of their consent. And then we need to invest in prevention and intervention. So that means, you know, passing laws at the federal level that make this a criminal offense, like the SHIELD Act. The SHIELD Act has been proposed as an amendment to the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act of 2021. And it's a bipartisan measure that addresses the unauthorized disclosure of private, sexually explicit visual imagery. And it eliminates the unfair requirement to prove that the perpetrator had an intent to harm the victim. So research that we've done at CCRI shows that most perpetrators do not explicitly intend to harm or embarrass the victim when they commit this crime. Often they're doing it because they are bragging, they're proud. They do it for the upvotes, they do it for the likes, they may do it to make money because it's sexually arousing for them. There's a million reasons. The SHIELD Act eliminates the requirement that perpetrators be shown to have a harm motive, and therefore it covers more victims and protects more victims. We also need to invest in resources for people who are victimized. So the CCRI helpline is an amazing resource, but there's no way that they could actually handle all the victims that the United States has. So we need more hotlines. We need more money for hotlines. We need therapists to be better informed about this type of violence and its negative consequences so that they can treat survivors from a trauma-informed perspective. Developing a culture of zero tolerance, educating people about harms, avoiding victim blaming, and investing in prevention and intervention.
Excellent. And something we talk about on the show a lot is how good cyber hygiene is now being developed at younger and younger ages, of course, especially with remote learning during the pandemic and things like this. So although no one foresees this as an outcome when they're sharing this type of content with their, significant others, what have you, are there any best practices that people should be aware of, or is there anything that parents should be on the lookout for, especially just as technology becomes more complex?
I mean, all of my suggestions have to do with helping people who are potential perpetrators to understand that doing this is illegal and hugely harmful to victims. None of my suggestions have to do with victims changing their behavior or being concerned about behaviors that might indicate victimization. Now, of course, if someone is in a abusive relationship, that may indicate that they may be pressured to send intimate images, and those images may be exposed without their consent. But really, my recommendations have to do with people who receive these images, recognizing that you're not to show it to another soul, and that once something is shared by text or online, it's nearly impossible to remove. So, you know, this is not a one-time act. Sharing something like this online traumatizes and re-traumatizes the victim and appears in some way, shape, or form for the rest of their lives. So perpetrators need to understand how hugely harmful this is.
Right. And I was reading some articles about, you know, some online hosting sites, and sometimes they're unaware that the material being uploaded falls into these categories. So what more can be done in that vein, if you know anything around that?
You know, I don't really, but okay.
It seems pretty complex.
I know exactly what you're talking about. There, you know, Pornhub, for example,
right,
was recently revealed to be a distributor of non-consensual porn. And I'm sure they would say it was unbeknownst to them, but
right,
there have to be legal ways to ensure that the content that you're providing your consumers was created and is being disseminated consensually.
Right. Right. Exactly. And so CCRI, the victim helpline, is, for anyone listening, it's 1-844-878-CCRI. Are there any other resources you would want to direct people to who are perhaps victims of non-consensual pornography? And, you know, I'm sure that's very scary and they are not quite sure where to go and who to turn to.
I would also go to this CCRI website. It's cybercivilrights.org, and they have a whole set of resources for victims, an online removal guide, information about attorneys who will take your case for reduced fees. They tell you the laws in your state. They answer frequently asked questions. So this, I would also direct them to the website.
Okay, great. And for those who are experiencing online harassment that isn't sexual, are there any resources you would direct those folks to?
Yes, CCRI is also a place that deals with online bullying and harassment. Although it's not what it's best known for, but they also deal with that. And I can provide you some other resources after the podcast. I'll email them to you.
Perfect. Yeah, we can include those in the description of the episode for folks. That's great. Excellent. Well, Dr. Eaton, this has been so wonderful. Before we go, are there any closing thoughts or anything you'd want to leave listeners with as we wrap up the episode?
You know, just to tell victims that they're not alone, that this type of crime has been escalating in recent years, and you're not to blame, you're not alone. There are communities of people in your position who day by day are recovering. You have legal recourse in most places, and I encourage listeners in general to express their support for the SHIELD Act to their congresspersons. It's a bipartisan bill to address online exploitation of private images. It's crafted with support from the CCRI, and it would give us a comprehensive law protecting sexual privacy in the U.S.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Eaton, thank you so much for joining us and speaking to us about what you do with CCRI. And it's just really important. So I really appreciate your work and taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Dr. Asia Eaton, Associate Professor of Psychology at Florida International University and Head of Research at CCRI, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. CCRI's mission is to combat online abuses that threaten civil rights and civil liberties. To learn more about CCRI, visit cybercivilrights.org, and you can listen to all of our podcast episodes at cybercrime.radio.